Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona. It's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell stories that the traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Joe Haldeman of Fit and Seal. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
And Link Miller of Sandler Training here in Arizona. Welcome, Link.
How you doing, Adrian?
I am super. Thank you both for joining me. Joe, I'd like to start with you, and we'll get a little bit of history and backstory about your company and the product that you are just bringing to market. Then we'll talk to Link, and I'm sure that in the course of this conversation, we're going to have some things emerge that we're going to want to all talk to each other about. So we'll do that here at the end. Joe, introduce us to Fit and Seal. What's the product?
It is going to be a universal seal for any existing commercially produced beverage, plastic beverage bottle. I have created a seal that I went and got a patent on, and the seal fits inside every commercial plastic bottle.
So we're talking water bottles you buy in a gigapack at Costco, all the way to things that you get a Gatorade in?
You got it. Any plastic commercial beverage bottle. It's actually even working in other beverage bottles like the cardboard box ones. So what I've done is I seal the top of it, and I've outfitted the top of it with several different products such as straws. We have a nipple for the for like a baby bottle, and we also have a sippy cup top. We also have a spray bottle that you can actually spray fluids from. So basically just pick any bottle you want, stick one of my tops in it, and go for it.
Now, why does the world need this product? What problem does it solve?
This solves the problem of finding an additional container to pour your beverage into. So you will save, obviously, time. You can just pull off the cap and stick my top on it. It will save the convenience of not having to clean that bottle. Also, the start of this whole process is I've got three small children, and the three small children all needed something to drink, usually at the same time. And I'd go over to the cupboard and I'd open up and grab me a sippy cup bottle, and I look for the lid, and then I would just look for the straw. And
right.
By the time I've done with three children, I've kind of going crazy here.
So I have two boys, 5 and 7, and I know exactly what this is like. There's a place in the drawer that has about 18 different sizes and lengths. They don't all fit the same bottles. Some of them are for bottles we don't have anymore, but we might want the straw for something like a project or maybe drinking soup out of a bowl. So there you are, rummaging in the drawers and the cupboards, trying to match this stuff up, and you get a bright idea?
I said, why can't I give my kid this bottle without him spilling it? So I took my chances several times, and every time, you know, the orange juice, the naked juice, the water, whatever you give them, is spilt on the floor within a few minutes. So I went online, and I started looking for some other products that I could just fit any bottle with. And I did. I actually found a couple that screw on, but it only fits some of the bottles. It wouldn't fit all of them. Now you've got the Gatorade and all these other bottles with the largemouth top, and it didn't fit any of those. So I was like, I have to figure out something that's going to just cap these bottles, and there's not one out there. I'm doing it. And I started going through all my processes, is figuring out how I can give my kid a drink without having to change the bottle out.
I can't tell you how many times I'm driving. And, you know, the two boys they're young enough, they're both still in car seats, and they're in the back. I'm trying to reach around and hand something back there, you know, leave your brother alone, take this bottle, right? And of course, if it was a green juice or something of that nature, there's no way. I'm like, no, you got to wait till we get there, because I know what's going to happen to that, and I'm going to be cleaning out of the cracks for the next 10 years.
Exactly.
Now, how did you design a lid that would fit different size necks?
It was a long process of R&D. A couple different ideas came out first. One of my first ideas was actually to take a plastic bottle, actually leave the lid on it, and make a straw that punctured the side of it, kind of like a Capri Sun or a juice pack.
Right.
That was not a good idea. You have a sharp object you're giving to your kid. So that was not a good idea. So I went to some different processes of plugging the bottle top of it. And after about the fourth try of drawing something out, having the guy who does the files, the CAD, I forget his name. He's an engineer. It makes all my CAD files, but he sends it over. We send it over to the molding, and the moldings come back, and this one didn't work. Oh, that one didn't work. Finally, we got one that worked. We had to separate the little ceiling fins so many different times, and the shape of it so many different times. Finally, we got one that's just golden, and now we started producing it.
You grew up here in Arizona. Your family's been in Arizona a long time, and you have a background in outdoor adventures. This isn't your first company. I'd love to hear a little bit more about Arizona Outdoor Fun and also how that perspective of needing to drink and stay hydrated, doing outdoor activities in rugged environments has informed some of your thinking about Fit and Seal. So tell us about Arizona Outdoor Fun.
Well, thanks for asking. That company I started 12 years ago. I went, it's kind of funny how I started that one. I felt the need. I went and rented some ATVs one day and I had to go to some guy's house to find them. There wasn't a store that rented them. None of the dealerships rented ATVs. So I decided, hey, I'm going to start renting ATVs myself. And I started a little website and eventually started getting a lot of hits and bought more ATVs and got into more items to rent, such as jet skis, canoes, kayaks, pontoon boats, bass boats, ski boats, all the accessories. And we started, Arizona Outdoor Fun was born back in 2007. And from then we've been at Lake Pleasant. We've been at Bartlett Lake as the jet ski rental company. We've moved on to having our own facility and up at Black Canyon City now, where we have our own shooting range. And everyone kind of just comes out right to our spot now and shows up and ride. And it's a very successful business. People come out and ride. We focus on the tourism industry. And I can't say much more about it, but come out and ride and shoot at Arizona Outdoor Fun anytime you want.
Now, you were mentioning to me before we came into the studio that one of the ways you've built that business as you got more and more focused on, cutting out the boats and jet skis and the multiple lake locations and so on, really focusing on the ATVs and the shooting. You've gotten also focused not just on the general public, but specifically on corporate events and making connections with event planners. How does that dimension of the business fit in with what somebody who's running a large event or conference is looking for?
So that was the thing is, in this industry, in the tourism industry, you really have to find that one guy, that one time that wants to ride an ATV. And so I focused on obviously the internet and SEO and hotels. And then from there, you really create relationships with all the hotels you can and create relationships with the meeting planners, the destination meeting companies that are out here and, become part of the Chamber of Commerce, the Visitors Bureaus, the Arizona Office of Tourism. You want to become members of all that stuff and you really want to just make a name for yourself in the Arizona tourism industry. So when you are looking for that one guy, that one time who wants to ride an ATV, you find him. The corporate events, you go out there and once you get a name for yourself, more and more people are seeing, hey, they came back and they had a great time. Let's use them again. So that's where that has came. Over the years, we did have boats and jet skis and pontoon boats and bass boats for rent. And we were spread out so thin. We were at 3 or 4 lakes around the valley. We were at Bartlett. We still have access to use Canyon, Saguaro, and Bartlett. And then Lake Pleasant, we were stationed at. So being spread so thin was pretty kind of difficult to run as a small company. And we were focused on where are we making our money? And we focused on, hey, the ATV tours, let the marinas handle the lakes. They're out there on site. So we've got our on-site spot where people just show up and ride. We don't have to trailer anything out the desert. We have our own facility and it's close to Phoenix, right up in Black Canyon City. So that's kind of where, you see where you're making your money and just weed out the parts that aren't.
When it comes to Fit and Seal, this is a totally different ballgame. So with that experience in the relationship building, the becoming preferred vendors with variety of different outfits that would want to use your services, bundle them with things, you're now moving into a consumer product brand. Different ballgame. So some of the internet experience, SEO, search, social will help. How are you thinking about how you're going to grow Fit and Seal? What's the vision? What's the strategy?
We are knocking on doors. We are obviously doing social media and website promotions and stuff like that. But the main thing is to actually knock on the doors. You can actually go to each big box store. You can go to their website, their vendor applications, and actually apply and submit your products. You can send them products and just work on each store one at a time. And there's also trade shows where the trade shows will actually schedule you at a booth, and then they'll schedule as many buyers as they can from the big box stores to actually come meet with you. And as a vendor, we pay for that. And then as the buyers, it's free for them to come in. So we'll sit there and we'll have our meetings with each vendor and show them our product and hopefully get purchase orders. We're directly in the startup stage of this company. We actually just got our first fit and seals about 2-3 months ago, and we're working on packaging right now. If somebody wants to buy some, I'd send them without packaging. But right now we're gearing up for the big show. It's actually going to be this year in the Phoenician. It's called the Baby ECRM. And right now we have 30 meetings with big box stores, and it's coming up this month.
So those are high pressure meetings to a certain degree. You've got to present the product. You've got to talk and answer their questions. Those questions, some of them you might anticipate, some of them you might not. How are you preparing for that big show, Baby ECRM?
Luckily, we've worked with the product long enough. We can go through it and show them the convenience and the good parts and everything about it. The price point is what they like. Their margins are what they like. It's the thing about prepping for a show like this is educate yourself. Just learn as much as you can from people that have already been there, done that, and try to join some groups, other marketing groups, and just focus on educating yourself on how to present this product and get it out there. Because I think the product speaks for itself. If I had something that didn't really speak for itself and didn't create a convenience and I didn't have a patent on, then I would have to work a little bit harder. But once I show everyone this, they are just thrilled to have it.
Are the relationships you want to build with big retailers, is that the primary channel distribution strategy, or are you also building a direct-to-consumer aspect of the business?
Both.
What are your thoughts on channel conflict? Are you creating a situation where Target, Walmart, REI, I don't know, but this isn't my field, I'm just guessing, where would I see this, is competing with your Instagram direct-to-dads and moms aspect of selling the product?
So that's a good question, and I am actually not educated enough to answer that.
I'm barely educated enough to ask it. So
So what I'll have to do is I'll have to do trial and error. If I have a situation where I'm competing with myself, you have to go and say, hey, what's going to be the best route here? Where do you want to sell this at? Where do you want to make more money? Where do you not want to compete with yourself at and upset some people that are selling a lot more than you can sell yourself?
Right, for sure. Now, Link Miller, Sandler Training, you are an expert in sales training, and in equipping people. We want to hear a little bit about your story, but I see you there in your seat wanting to jump into this part of the conversation. So what do you got for Joe?
Well, Joe, I think this is a wonderful idea. Having been a child and spilled many things, but also having had three children who still spill things, and one's 24 and the other's 22. So, and I got a 9-year-old as well. So having something like this would be beneficial to my house. Curiously, where is the actual end goal here that you're trying to shoot for with Fit and Seal? As in, is this something that you want to ride off into the distance, or is this something that you want to make big enough that you sell to somebody?
That is a very good question. Mm-hmm. I personally would like to take this as big as I can. Mm-hmm. And I have other ideas. I have other products in mind. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't mind continuing this business and sharing the other great products I have in mind.
Okay. So you currently, your ATV business, which by the way, I'm finally glad I met you because I've been trying to figure out where to rent these things. Living in Arizona off and on for 20 years. Those customers that you have, how many of them have children?
Probably 40, 50% of them, I'm sure.
And how many of them love you and the ATV services that you have provided?
That would say about 95% of them.
And 95% of them wouldn't benefit from having a exclusive demo of a new product that you're rolling out that can be used in camping, can be used in all those other places, so that the narrative fits to them, that you would generate a groundswell. It wouldn't be immediate, but it would take time. But you have 95% of your client base, which I would assume are thousands.
Yes.
Something in there is going to get the attention of those big boxes. Big box stores, when they see that there's a churn, or not a churn necessarily, but a turn in product purchase, that becomes more enticing for them to be aware of. It's actually a propaganda strategy that would be used in this case, plus this narrative of the story of you driving and your kids spilling stuff and then handing them a sharp object and let them stab at it and see how that didn't work.
Well, I tell you, you've kind of taken the words out of most of my employees out there. They want me to get them a bunch of the straws. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be great for the ATVs. You know, having to take the cap off, and why these guys are, you know, cause everyone just like throws the water bottles in their backpack or sticks them on the ATV compartment and they want to just grab it. I think the straws would be great. And then the other thing is we probably have done most corporate companies out there, on a tour.
Mm-hmm.
If you name a company, they've probably been out there. I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to get it out there for sure.
This is an idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Link, you're showing a little bit of your methodology here at work, and I want to create some context for this so people can understand the thinking behind the thinking. You've been with Sandler since, in one form or another, since 2000.
One form or another since 2000.
So how did that...
Well, actually, I started in 99, actually, just the end of 99 as a student. I went to remember the days when you could fax broadcast and people would send you your fax for your advertisements and you're like, someone actually sent me a fax and I was like, man, really? So I had to go through the scrolls to find the thing. And in between going through the scrolls, I found this topic that said how to sell on value, not price. So I decided, oh, I'll give this a shot.
And it was faxed to me. Right.
Yes.
By the way, side note, I had a professor is now passed at UC Berkeley who wrote several volumes of office folklore based entirely on the cartoons and jokes and chain letters and other nonsense.
Interesting.
That was faxed in the late 80s, early mid 90s. So carry on. So there you are. You're going through the facts stuff.
Going through the facts stuff.
This is a blast
scrolls,
to the past.
And it was the scrolls that rolled out.
You're under 30, a fax machine was something that would actually connect to your phone line and then essentially print out a piece of paper that somebody had put into their fax machine on the other end.
It was magic.
Think texting for dinosaurs.
Yes. Yes. Well, yeah, that's true. You're dating us now.
Well, yes. That's okay.
Well, that's okay. Sorry. Well, 20. I was in 2000. That would be coming into my 20th year. I actually was a student. Then I was an associate working for a gentleman by the name of Greg Nanijan on the East Coast. And then I started working with Global Accounts. And then while working with Nanijan, and then that was in Boston. And then I moved to Arizona and took over a franchise here, and built out that franchise, and then had an opportunity to go back to work for Global Accounts to be on a plane around the world training all types of interesting people. And then came back, and now I've worked with my business partner, Mark Kirstein, here in Arizona. We have about seven people on our sales team. And our real world is how to allow people to see the whole picture, not just see the single behavior that they need to be following that will lead them to a dead end. Let them see both perspectives. So Sandler is a process or a system for understanding individuals and really about how to understand how people want to buy things, not selling to people, letting them buy.
Let's talk a little bit about the Sandler brand. It's one of the most well-known, well-respected sales training methodologies or sales systems. David Sandler in the late 60s was a student of human psychology. He was fascinated by, if I understand correctly, transactional analysis, other ways of asking questions to reveal deeper underlying human things. Talk a little bit about the Sandler approach.
The Sandler approach is looking at the salesperson or the person in their role as a salesperson. That could be the owner who has to be. I mean, honestly, you think about it, an owner of a business or an entrepreneur. I mean, aren't you the top salesperson at your organization? Because you're selling either concept or process or policy. All the way through.
Yep. And the owner.
The owner. And so it really came into helping ownership of the actual profession, helping the ownership of the profession so where that an individual could feel comfortable. Because if you use, you know, the word salesperson in certain circles, that's literally a four-letter word that does not start with luck. You know, it's, oh boy, I don't want to deal with this type of person. And no one wants to be sold to. Which is really the reality of most sales processes is that they try to sell to someone. When in Sandler's world, it was, let me understand you. And through transactional analysis, understanding how your patterns were inlaid or laid on to you from your childhood. And also how you and then interpreted how your parent interacted with you. So at the same time that you were gathering this information of how you were supposed to behave because you're being guided by your parent, you were also watching your parent, how your parent was guiding you. And that simply plays out in everyday life. And then when you think about our brain, how magical and how wonderful our brain is, all of this is going on at the same time. And a lot of it is you're not even aware of, you're not even conscious to, because you see the pattern, you just fall into that pattern and you go. You don't really consciously think about where you're going to go and where it's going to end up. So when we think about our customers and in the Sandler model, it's really, who is my customer? What does my customer look like? And I like to use the, I've gotten, my colleagues have said, Link, why are you always talking this coffee and conversation piece? Well, let's get together and have a face-to-face and have a coffee and conversation. Talk to each other. Explore. But explore like two little kids who just met each other on the playground for the first time and are like, hi, I'm Link. And they reach their hand out or they say hello to somebody. This is what sales should be about. It should be allowing the other person to buy, because the other person's trying to get their needs met. It should never be our needs that gets met. And if you're in sales for money, get out. You're hurting our profession.
Some sales training focuses on tactics and techniques. Say this, do this, get that.
Get out, get it, and go.
Sounds like Sandler's approach has a very different mindset and even whatever is underneath mindset, kind of set of principles and commitments. Clarify the difference between the Sandler system or methodology and other sales methodology people might be familiar with. Spin selling,
sure.
Challenger sale, et cetera.
Challenger, both Challenger and Spin have their origins within our world. They have Sandler, and look, Sandler was not unique other than he looked at, if you really wanted to know about sales, if you want to know how people think or how people buy, study psychology. Study how the person gets up in the morning. Study how they make their bed. Study if you put a plate of, you've heard the marshmallow test, put a bunch of marshmallows in front of a bunch of five-year-olds and see which one takes it. Well, the one who takes it is in that immediate gratification. Well, that has ramifications based on how that child was raised, how they were scripted. So Sandler's process or our process that we operate from Mercury, which is the franchise that Mark and I own, is that we really want to understand the person. And we understand what they want to accomplish. So my question to you, Joe, was like, what do you want to really accomplish? Get to that base piece. What is it that you're really trying to do? And then look at what are the things that will stop you from getting there or can help you to get there. So there's a lot of psychology. There's a lot of coaching that goes into Sandler. Yes, there is a system. And yes, there are tactics. Do this and you'll get that. But our world is, we'll show you the tactics, and we call it, here's the sizzle. But if you want the meat and potatoes, in fact, if you want to know how to grow the cow and you want to know how to plant the potatoes so that will keep coming back, this is where we're at. This is where we're at with Sandler. So it's about taking your customer and giving them that experience that they really want. We talk about in our bonding strategies, there's, you know, visual, auditory, kinesthetic. This is the way a person views the world. There's transactional analysis. There's the adult, the parent, and the child that are arguing and working within each other or working against each other. You have the DISC model, which helps us to understand how people in their most comfortable levels, they will act and behave and how they interpret emotion. So all of this is not for you to use on someone. This is for you to observe how they want to be communicated to. Allow them to buy what they want. Salespeople have been conditioned, say this, do this, get the deal. It's about numbers. But I don't know about you guys. We're all in sales. At the end of the day, when you've done the, it's just about the numbers and the numbers don't come back the way you like, how defeated do you feel? Versus, what did I do wrong? What did I do right? What is the behavior that went into how I was approaching this? What I was saying? That's why I said, if you don't love sales, you got to love every piece of this, even the points of getting your teeth kicked in. Because it's going to happen.
A game isn't won on the scoreboard. A game is won on the field of play. If you don't like the numbers on the scoreboard, you can't climb up there and do something about the number. You've got to get back into the game. What's the game?
The game. The game is understanding when you really want to say something, don't. That's the real game. Because salespeople have been taught that they need to say this, they need to say that. If you slow down and just observe, you'll actually see that that person will open up completely to you of what they want to understand. I mean, we've had conversations with people and I'll ask a question and the way I ask the question, the other person will be offended by it and I'll have to back off because I was pushing too far. See, it's always the questions. It's never the telling. When you ask the questions, you allow the other person to fall into what they want to fall into, and you provide the lifeline for them to continue that, you have a customer for life. Your customers, Joe, that have been with you multiple times. Here's another thing. Go back and look at your numbers. The people that have been and come back multiple times, those are your neophiliacs. They're the ones that are talking about you. They're the ones that are tweeting about you. They're the ones that are going to be your internal, external sales team. I mean internal, they're internal to you, but they're external. You don't pay them. But you incentivize them to carry your message forward.
So slowing down to speed up. I remember, man, summer of 2003. I was in Baghdad in Iraq.
Hot place.
It was pretty hot. Yeah. So Phoenix is not a problem for me. I've lived in a much hotter place. I was working for a humanitarian relief organization. I had previously been reporting for Newsweek. I was attending in this kind of media and policy advisor role, the what we used to call the 5 o'clock funnies, which was a briefing that the U.S. military had for journalists and aid workers who were in Baghdad during this really weird period between the time that the U.S. took over administering the country and the time that an independent Iraqi government, somewhat independent Iraqi government, was essentially stood up. A Marine colonel explained to people that the slogan that they operated by is slow is smooth and smooth is fast. When you say slow down, are you talking about in the actual conversation? Are you talking about in the entire sales process? Are you talking about in your own thinking? Unpack slow down to speed up.
Yes to all of that. Slowing down in your own thinking. We are constantly being flooded by stimulus and data and this pattern and that pattern. When you slow down to really observe not only that you saw what you saw, but what were the factors that may have contributed to what you saw? So think of it as a lake. Now, a lake is fed by streams, by rivers, and it all feeds into it. And then it does what it does, or it evaporates and moves back up in the atmosphere. And so it's all cyclical. It all cycles amongst itself. So when you think about a sales call or you think about a relationship, how often do we rush in? And I like to use the, you go home, Joe, you're married?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Okay. So you remember when you were married and you came home and you said, how was your day? What you wanted to do is find out what was waiting on you or what was there, what you had to deal with. So this slow down in a lot of places when we just come in and we just start firing off, this is what we're going to do, how it's going to happen, this is what's going to, the other person is just not even paying attention. They're not even wanting to be in that conversation. So when you slow down your thinking, did I observe what I really observed? Or did I observe something that now is triggering me to act a certain way? Instead of being triggered or having this cue, slow down and actually ask yourself, what is feeding into this lake of emotion that I have right now? Why do I want this? So when we talk about slow down to speed up, Joe, did you ever play a sport?
Absolutely.
What'd you play?
Soccer.
Soccer. Greatest game ever. Biggest game in the world. That's that thing with the ball. Okay, I just want to make sure. It's not the oblong one with the laces. No, not that one. Okay. So you say, what position should you play? You look like you might have been a center.
A fullback.
Fullback. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're coming down the pitch. Mm-hmm. See, I got it right, didn't I? I was going to say court. It's the pitch, right?
Right.
And coming down the pitch or the field, and you got a breakaway, and the goalie's right there. Do you run as fast as you possibly can and kick it right at that moment?
No.
What? You're a breakaway. I mean, you hit the goal. You get to rip your shirt off, skin around. What? Yeah. No.
Nope. Usually, you grab that ball and you kick it around a little bit past. See who's going to be the next shot, and then.
So you slow down before you actually make your move.
Yeah. Play keep away from the guy in front of you. Yep.
Play keep away from the guy in front of you. Now, if it was just you and you're a breakaway by yourself, no one's there, no one to pass to, would you still slow down to measure up where you're going to put that ball?
There's nothing in the way?
Yeah.
Sure.
There's nothing in the way. So there's always this thing that's in the way of us, which is our willingness to run forward and our need of approval to be the greatest. What if we just slowed down just a little bit? We watched basketball. The NBA finals were on last night. How often do you see some guy run down to get a jam and he doesn't pay attention and the ball bounces off because he didn't slow down? Right at the last second when you go for that shot, everything stops, everything slows down. Same thing with the sales call. If you slow down and let the other person show you where you want them to, you know, what you need to say or what they want you to say, that's an easier play versus take that strategy and use that strategy and get those numbers. Slow down. Create a relationship.
Link, I got a question for you about selling sales training. this is a little bit meta. It's like when you look into the mirrors in the barbershop and they go back and forth to infinity.
Mm-hmm.
You have experience selling, and you have experience selling sales training.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between selling sales training and selling anything else?
If you want to label it to make yourself feel better that there is a difference, by all means, slow down to speed up. But for me, when I realized I was hunting humans, then it was, that's the commonality to behind the whole thing. It's still a human. And when you hunt humans, and I don't mean hunting like we're cannibalizing and that kind of thing, but hunting to let them get what they want, let them get to where they want to go. It became unique that each person is doing certain things for their own reasons. And if you help them to get what they want, they're going to be there. So hunting for me was a great analogy. Fishing was a great analogy. Because may not have the right bait. You may not have the right, my dad used to say, and I would say something wrong. He's like, you're not holding your mouth right. And I used to look at him like, I don't get it. And what he was saying was that I was letting my emotions get in the way of what the other person wanted to accomplish. And that's what we have a problem with when we don't slow down to speed up. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it's really the difference between being a salesperson and sales training is you still have the one unique identifier, the lowest common denominator, that's a human that's sitting across from you.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation flying all over the world, and Sandler is one of the largest international sales organizations. There are experts in many different markets. What's common and what's different? In other words, how much of this is what we might call cultural or linguistic, and how much of it is human?
I think it's all human, but there are elements that play in the cultural and ethical and moral boundaries that play between that. When you work in an organization that is really basing itself on helping to understand people, it's then understanding the environmental culture, the environment, how the environment affects the buying and selling habits or the patterns. It even comes into, like when I lived in Guam and I was running a wireless company. This was way before Sandler. And I thought things moved extremely slow until someone told me, well, we don't have but two seasons, hot and wet. So there was never this urgency that was scripted into the tribes there to have this finality of having something done. Now, I grew up in a farm in Indiana that we had to milk cows. So there was an urgency at 4 a.m. because the cow's gonna have a problem and it's gonna stop milking, and you gotta keep that process going. And also at 7 o'clock or 5 o'clock when the sun was going down, the cow needed to let go of the milk as well, because that's what the cow was created for in that scenario. So when you look at the different environments at different places, it's still understanding that people are still herds. They're a herd of people. They think a certain way. They operate a certain way. When you deal in the Middle East, like when you were in Baghdad, everything had Islam as a baseline behind it. You go to Western Europe, everything has Christianity as a baseline behind it. And they're similar. And that plays into some how people think. You might go to the Middle East, or not Middle East, you might go to Africa, and there's a different tribal context that plays into this. And without coming in and being judgmental, it's about helping, how do you find those patterns that the people that you're working with live within, and then you mirror and move within that.
The best salesperson, the best marketer, the best entrepreneur, the best leader is an anthropologist first, and an imperialist second.
Absolutely.
You can build the biggest ethical empire you want, but only if you understand who's actually doing the building. Because at a certain point, it's no longer just you.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it makes you a leader. Joe, I'm curious to bring it back to your upbringing here in Arizona. Link's throwing out a lot of stuff about childhood environment, about the way that shapes how you think. How would you say your outlook on life and business has been shaped by your personal history, your family's history here in this state?
I grew up basically oldest of three other sisters, and kind of like the man of the house as a young child. And I would say that kind of just made me feel as an adult that anything you want, I learned early in life, anything I want, I need to work for. Anything I want to do, I need to do myself. Don't rely on anyone else unless you find the right person and you've trained them how you want to do it. So I would say this, my childhood and growing up, taught me, you know, to go for things that you want. Don't stop until, you know, you've succeeded or completely failed and give it up.
When did you first realize that this path of independent entrepreneurship was for you as opposed to working in somebody else's organization?
I would say right as a teenager, at 13 years old, you know, just realizing, hey, if I want to have this cool stuff and have that cool stuff, I need to make some money and I can have it. It was kind of like, hey, do I want this for myself or do I want this for my friends or my lifestyle? I need to work for it. It's not going to come for free. I wasn't really from a well-to-do family. So, you know, my mom worked at a bank and she was divorced. And basically, you know, I remember going to a lot of daycares as a kid and staying with my grandparents a lot. And anything you really want, you really had to work for yourself.
As you've worked with a lot of different staff, a lot of different employees, a lot of different people on your leadership team over the years, what do you think are some of the qualities that are necessary for someone to be an employee in an entrepreneurial venture like Arizona Outdoor Fun and like Fit and Seal? In other words, neither of those are what we would call typical corporate environments that have the kind of cubicle, you know, W-2 security kind of thing. I mean, there's some of that to a certain extent. What does it take for someone to be a successful employee in organizations like yours?
I think any organization you work for, you need to want to be there. You want to enjoy your life and job. You want to be miserable at work all day. So that's going to be the first thing. I find people that really want to be outdoors, that want to be outdoorsmen. They want to be tour guides. They like customer service. They like people. You have to find the right person for the job, for sure. So going through, you know, all the employees had over the years, you know, you got some people that enjoy or think they want to ride ATVs all day, but after about a week, they're done. You know, they're done. And then you got guys that are still with me, you know, years down the road. I would say that when you look for an employee, let them know everything ahead of time of how it's going to run. I remember hiring my tour guides and saying, listen, you know, you don't have any days off. You won't know what you're doing till that night at 7 p.m. You won't know what you're doing the next day. And you won't know when you're getting off. You will know when you're supposed to be there. You don't have any holidays or any weekends off. And I tell them that. We're busy. You'll have 2 days off during the week if we're not too busy. I let them know that it slows down the summer. So save all your money in the winter because the tourists are here. So if you're an employer and you're looking for a good employee, that's just let them know everything, what they're going to encounter up front in the company they're going to work for.
Link, can anybody be a good salesperson? Or is there something that's unique to certain types of mindsets and upbringing?
Well, I think the greatest way to explain that, in my personal opinion, is I played college football. And I was good enough to maybe have gotten a tryout. But I wasn't the specimen that I needed to be. I didn't have the physical aptitude that's required for that. So yes, anyone can be a good salesperson. But to be a great salesperson, much like everybody else who is a professional, this takes practice and lots and lots and lots of practice. I think it's amazing how the training that goes into a lot of corporate identity, which is here's your box, here's your paperwork, here, go through a week of training, and this is what you're going to run into, go. And they never train again. They never go back to, you know, Vince Lombardi said winning is a habit. Well, a habit means that you've had to done something over and over again, which means you'd have to do all the things that were necessary to do that beforehand. You'd have to get up early. You'd have to do the practice. You'd have to go what? You'd have to know that you're going to start somewhere, but you may not know where you're going to end. And that's okay. So that's really, to be a great salesperson, takes a lot of practice and has to take a lot of self-respect, self-inspection and self-reflection of, well, what did I do there? What did I cause here? There's no such thing as a bad prospect. There's only bad salespeople who didn't pay attention and threw out what they wanted to do versus asking what the other person wanted to do.
Joe, can anybody be an entrepreneur?
Well, I was going to comment on the anyone be a sales first.
Yeah, please.
I was going to say that I think that myself, am a horrible salesperson, but I can sell my product in my company better than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might go for a lot of business owners.
It does.
Anyone to be an entrepreneur, of course, anyone can. You just need to be ready for the journey. You need to be ready to have no money or have lots of money, be able to deal with people, be able to work for yourself, be able to self-motivate. You know, you're no one's going to wake up in the morning and tell you what to do. You have to do it yourself. You have to think ahead of time, plan your weeks, your months, your year out. I would say educate yourself before you plan something like that, because it's not going to fall into your lap. You're going to have to work every day twice as hard as you've ever worked for yourself or anyone else.
You started Arizona Outdoor Fund in 2007, which was a year before it became really tough to be in the tourism industry. Like a lot of industries, and especially in states like ours, there was a lean period from late 2008 to, I don't know, 2010-ish, 11. What was your experience and how did you make it through that?
I figure, yeah, 2007 and 2008 was the drop. I mean, the housing market fail. So the economy was bad. And I tell you, I remember back in the day, I remember a couple of the dealerships that sold ATVs when I was just starting were going out of business, but I was actually doing very well. And I thought to myself, maybe no one can afford to buy, but they can afford to rent. And I did make it through without a glitch. My business excelled every year since it started, and sales have been up every year since it started. So I never really saw the impact of that. And focusing on the business, Outdoor Fun, on the tourism industry and creating relationships was the key factor. With Fit and Seal, the new product, the new company that I'm talking about today, I'm going to have to really educate myself on where to market this to. And we're in a different world. Back when I started Outdoor Fun, Facebook didn't know what you liked. Now they know everything you like. So you can pick your audience on who you want to show this to. You can pick it to show it to the parents and the athletes. I think the Fit and Seal would be great for the cyclists or the runners or the hikers. So when I market to people, now I can actually choose my market. I'm just going to have to educate. I don't want to show this to people that don't want it, but I'd like to show it to people that do want it. A lot of the big box stores are saying, hey, this would be great as a little strip clip hanging next to the water in the beverage section, or this would be great hanging in just in the aisles, you know, of the juice section, or REI likes it over by the containers, you know. So there's all different places of where I'm going to place the Fit and Seal and who I'm going to market it to. So it's going to be a lot of education.
For direct-to-consumer brands, there's never been a greater opportunity to leverage the platforms that everybody with a smartphone, which is now everybody, who on average spends 60% of the 5 to 6 hours a day they spend looking at their phone, not to mention the 24 hours a day that the phone's within arm's reach, looking at a handful of apps, Facebook, Instagram, older folks, Twitter, business folks, LinkedIn, younger kids, TikTok. So the opportunity is there. And at the same time, there's never been more noise. There's never been more people trying to leverage those platforms to get their thing in front of people. When it comes to that digital strategy, how are you going after it? Do you have people who are carrying this forward for you? What's your thoughts about how to leverage the world we live in?
Well, back to the basics, we all have about a 2-second attention span when we're scrolling our phones.
So yeah,
So we have to catch them in that 2 seconds.
Yeah.
So we'll focus on that. Hire some experts that have figured this out already. And I think social media and educating people on what this is and how it's going to convenient their life. We're also focusing a little bit, kind of a lot, on the green aspect of it. I mean, instead of maybe throwing the water bottle out, save it, reuse it for something else, you know? So that could be a whole different market to the green community.
That's a really interesting play, because if you think about it, those are the same folks, some of them anyway, that eschew the use of single-use mm-hmm. plastics altogether. So you've got the folks who think, well, you know what? What I really want is the metal water bottle that I carry with me everywhere, and that's how I'm going to be eco, right? How I'm going to be green. And you've got other folks that maybe are aware of the fact that plastic is bad but haven't figured out what to do about it yet. What are your thoughts on how to approach the green aspect of this, the earth-conscious dimension of the marketplace?
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. Plastic, it will not go away. Plastic bottles won't go away.
But like literally, they won't go away. Like a million years from now, they're still here.
Exactly. They're here to stay. If we could reuse them for a couple times, that'd be great. if we can always recycle, that's one thing Fit and Sealed is going to focus on, is educating on recycle, reuse. I think that's just one of the main things. When you can market to that green community, you have to let them know how far you are on recycle or reuse. Even though we are creating more plastic to use this in a convenience factor for all the different people out there, we're also focusing on, hey, reuse this bottle. I got a bottle the other day. It was so cool. It was shaped kind of like a diamond. And I was like, I just put something else in here. You know, I mean, this is kind of the bottle maybe I want to reuse. You know, so that's, hopefully there's going to be a lot more of that happening.
Talk a little bit about designing and bringing this product to market. You mentioned before the engineer with the CAD drawings and the whole thing. You're not an engineer. You're not a product guy. You've used a lot of things, so you had opinions about it. What did you have to learn as you went through the process of really refining the design and making this a viable product?
So what I did is I went to the people that have already done stuff like this. There's stuff that you can stick in wine bottles that, you know, there's other stuff that plug the bottle. And I was looking at some other plugs in the construction industry, and I was just thinking, man, I can just looking at the bottle. If I had the, I can't show you on the radio, but if you look on our website, you can see the way it's shaped. I want to take all these little fins that pop out, and I want to be able to fit any size neck. I was just using my imagination. I was just looking at the bottle. I was like, I want to be able to squeeze the fins, put it in there and have them spread out no matter what size the neck is and have it seal. So I worked on creating some seals that came out with a little bit thicker ridges. And then I came out with some ones that were floppier and smoother. And then we came out with some ones that were a different durometer. Durometer is the hardness of the seal, the plastic, or it's not plastic, but it's the silicone. The hardness of the silicone to get it to stay in, but not fall out easily. And that was kind of the process. And how, once we got the shape, we had to go through the right hardness and the right length and just went on.
And is
on
it
and on.
Truly one size fits all, or are there multiple sizes of the Fit and Seal?
There's two sizes. So one size fits the 28 to 32 millimeter openings on all water bottles. And then the other size fits the 38 millimeter opening on all the rest of the big mouth bottles. And I know we're on the radio, but I did bring a bunch of bottles and Fit and Seals with me to show you afterwards. You can take pictures.
Yeah, I look forward to looking at those, take some pictures. And where would people go to see more of the product itself?
Fitandseal.com.
And if people want to follow this journey, connect with you, if they have ideas for how to support you, if they have people they want to introduce you to, buyers and suppliers and distributors and all the rest, where do they connect with you personally, Joe?
You know, you can just call me. But you can, you know, if you can connect with me through fitandseal.com, you can connect with me through my Instagram, Fit and Seal, Facebook, Fit and Seal, Twitter. And I mean, my phone number should be on there as well, the company phone number.
Joe Haldeman, owner and inventor really of Fit and Seal. Thanks for joining us on the show today. I want to have one final question for you. As you look for, you're in this momentous moment right now. You have, the product is done. It's not available in stores yet. You see where you want to go, but you're right in the middle of navigating how to get there. What's the one thing you come back to that keeps you on course? What are you telling yourself? How are you staying the course as you navigate this really uncertain period in bringing this product to the world?
I haven't really told myself anything but how great a product this is. I use them in my house. I use them with the kids. I hand them out to my sisters and their kids and anyone who wants them. I've been giving them out. Everyone's happy with them. I'm getting a lot of feedback. It's just the confidence I'm getting about the product. Because if I didn't really have that confidence, he could squash you. You know, he could be, you know, I have one buddy who just constantly dogs me about it. And he's just my buddy. That's what he does. Other than that, everyone says, it's a great product. I can't wait to see it in the stores. Keep going for it. Keep pushing whichever way you can. And as I said, I really don't know which way I want to sell these the most, but I just want to sell them to everybody because I think it's going to make the world a better place. And I'm a businessman.
Joe Haldeman, thank you very much indeed. Link Miller with Sandler Training. What do you want entrepreneurs and salespeople to know that perhaps they're not thinking about? How should they approach their business and their sales process differently?
Well, without being selfish, I would say to them, you're not alone. That moment that you feel that everything is not working the way it should be is the absolute time that you should really dig in and continue on with what you're doing. and then or give me a call and we can sit down and have a cup of coffee and a conversation. So we can try and figure out that there's a way that we can help you. We can't help everybody because some things we choose not to work within, but this is a part of our ethics and morals that we play from. And I was thinking about your bottle. The whole thing I was thinking about when you're talking about the fins was a clotting factor. Like this is a vein and this is a clotting factor that it won't let the water pass through. I just had this mental image of
white
or a blood cell just clotting up and not letting it making a membrane. So that was interesting. I just thought that came to my mind.
Link, if someone wants to take you up on your offer for coffee and conversation, where do they learn more about your organization and where do they connect with you personally?
They can go to mercury.sandler.com or they can go to sandlertraining.com and look up the locality and look for Mercury, look for myself or Mark. But I will tell you the greatest way to get a hold of me, bar none, just call me. The number's 480-285-6338. I will always take a call. Even the robo ones, I have fun with them.
All right, excellent. So for all the robots listening, go ahead and dial Link Miller. Link from Sandler Training, thank you very much for joining me. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.